Hey, welcome to the Limited Upside Live Chat. Ben, what's up?
Hey, Mike. Not much, man. Good to be back on the show. I've missed a few, but I'm happy to hear that things had gone smoothly in my absence.
Yeah, smoothly enough. You know, only a 30-minute delay on the last one. But yeah, so here's what I want to do today on this chat. And this is like a very listener-oriented chat. It's award season, Ben. It's the end of the regular season is coming. The MVP conversation is hitting full bore. All the other conversations are happening. And I find this time period to be a little frustrating because you have to, in order to give someone love, you have to add them to the conversation, even if they don't necessarily have a chance of winning. You only have one winner for these awards and only five places on the ballot for MVP, three for all the other awards. And so naturally, you know, it's not disrespectful really to be leaving someone out, but that's how it is often taken. These conversations can get toxic. Maybe I'm just online too much, Ben. Probably. I don't know what you think.
Yeah. I don't, I think when it was like discourse that was being talked about at a table or between friends at a bar or barbershop, or go down the list of places where people would congregate and maybe have this conversation historically, it probably was a little bit cleaner when it comes to how people express their opinions. But on Twitter, everything gets convoluted. There's no way around it. And everyone has an opinion, which is why we're doing this show, so people can have a platform to express their opinion on who their MVP candidate is. I think one thing that's made this year unique,
award, to be clear, you can talk about any award you want. Can make up an award.
Correct. And I think one thing that's made this year unique is we've had small market MVPs before in Oklahoma City. And that's certainly something that has occurred, and in Milwaukee. But those are not small market players. They're not. They were household names. Russell Westbrook is a household name. Kevin Durant. Giannis. They were not a foreign big man. And I think the unanimous nature of the season that Jokic is putting up, and a lot of this has to do with circumstance too.
I'm losing you a little bit. So because he's European, is that the issue? But what about Dirk?
Yeah. Look, man. Dirk was. How many years was Dirk in the league before he won an MVP?
Six or seven? No, not a decade. Not quite. He won in 2007. He was drafted in 1998.
So almost a decade.
Yeah, but remember, one of those years of the lockout. Anyway, Jokic has been in the league for how long? Like 7 years at this point? 6 years?
Yeah, but there's just a difference in this, which is like Jokic's season stands on its own. But the relationship to the competition all getting hurt makes this such a clear cut. Like, there isn't a very good argument outside of, you know, people who are going to, you know, push for their guy, because LeBron got hurt and because Embiid got hurt and because, like, Jokic's season probably would have been enough regardless, but it would have been a closer and a better argument to be made for both those guys had things kept going as they were going. But but that's the thing, Mike. Those guys did get hurt. And Jokic is still carrying a team where other key players on his team have gotten hurt, you know, in that type of proportion to the value he's put out there. I think it's pretty obvious. I mean, you heard Steve Nash say the other night, I think in a candid situation, someone like Doc would probably agree. It's just that's the case we have, is that Jokic is, he's just easier fodder for stupid talking heads. And that makes this thing such a more hot topic.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, that's a very long, convoluted way of saying you kind of won by default, but that's a whole separate conversation.
I think it's a close race that he wins, and deservingly so, had things continued to move as they were. And I think that it probably would have come down to the two centers who are leading, you know, in Joel's case, leading the best team in the East, in Jokic's case,
I would have. What about the guard from Golden State? But that's a whole bit deeper.
Sure. Yeah, but if Golden State wasn't a fringe playoff team, then I think if they're solidified in that middle pack, just like Denver is, and Denver's a high middle, you know, being that they're so separate from the top four, so separate from the next seeds in the West. But yeah, I think Steph is definitely. That's why five people make the ballot. Steph will be one of them. And it's an accomplishment in every possible way that he's led this ragtag group of 6'8" and unders to being in the playoff conversation. And I hope he lights up the list.
Six foot and unders. All right. 6 foot and unders. Well, I think we're already getting it. 6'8" and unders.
Yes.
We're already getting a little off track. The point of this show is that nobody is a bad candidate for any of these awards in this show. Your job, we are going to hear from you. We've already got a couple people who want to talk, and let's kind of get through them, is advocate for your guy. Make the positive case that you belong in this endless, giant, large conversation. And we imagine Ben and I as like the investors on Shark Tank who are deciding which argument to purchase. And we will decide whether your case is good. But the truth is everybody's case is good. So no longer can anyone complain that someone is not a part of the conversation and should be. The conversation is endless. So we will be taking arguments for all awards, MVP. I think we kind of don't need to talk about Jokic anymore. We can't. So let's say not the favorites, unless someone has something they want to say. Anyone else? So I see. Let's start with Matt. Matt King, King you are you on. Hello. Matt, you there? I can hear myself.
I can hear you as well, Mike. And now I can hear myself twice.
Well, hey, can you hear me now?
Matt, you there?
Yeah, I'm.
Yeah, I can hear. Is there construction in your background?
Yeah, let me pop outside real quick.
It's all good. There's construction in a lot of places now, I find. While we figure that out, I live next door to a water tower, and they are supposedly, I know, kind of random, right? Like the water district, and they're supposedly doing some big construction there in the fall. So I'm going to have a lot of that coming my way. Matt, is that better?
Yeah, is it?
Yes, Matt. What's up? Who do you want to make a case for what award?
All right, I want to make a case for Jokic, but for most improved player.
Oh, okay. What's the case? All right.
I think that obviously he was really good last year, but I suppose the other guy you would make a case for would be Julius Randle, but when you compare him to Jokic, Jokic made a leap from like a top 15, top 20 type player to a pretty clear top five. I think that's a bigger leap, especially when you can. I mean, it's a lot of the same argument for his MVP case, but I think the 3-point increase is a huge 3-point percentage increase from like 32% to 40%. That's pretty big. And he's not shooting them at a huge clip, but he's making enough of them that I don't think that that's too much noise. But yeah, I just think that that leap from top 15 to top five is a lot bigger than Randall's maybe top 50 to top 30 leap.
Can we qualify real quick? Do we think that Randle? So I would say Randle's probably a top 20 player this year, which is he probably is. I mean, it's not just statistically, he's actually probably significantly higher if you look at the kind of numbers he's putting up. But I do love this argument though, because Jokic, I think there's two parts to this. Number one, that the run that he's done for the last 10 games when the rest of the Nuggets decided to get hurt is nice, because you get to see just what he can do for the entirety of making anyone, like any other off guard, a viable player in the NBA. Like, I think the osmosis of Jokic is being felt in a different way this year.
Let this be the only NBA basketball podcast that uses the phrase osmosis to describe the value of an NBA player, and that's true. Effectively, and it makes sense.
Thank you. Well, Mike, let me ask you. You're someone, and Matt, I love this take here, and Mike, you're someone who's constantly looking through the annals of NBA history, and would you say that it is a more difficult leap to go from, let's say, top 15 to top 3, top 5, than it is to go from 50 to maybe 20? Is that something that you would assess as being, to Matt's point, like that holds water?
Yeah, you know, it's very funny you make this argument. I was I'm looking to find the exact date I did it. So in 2012, I made the same argument on SBNation.com for Kevin Durant. Basically the same idea. That, like, the leap from being really good to being one of the five best players in the league is more significant than a leap to 20th or whatever. And that should be reflected in the award. And if you look at the history of the award, it's very rarely interpreted that way. It's very much usually just like sort of the guy who wasn't a star level player, even like wasn't that good, becomes decent. Like, here are some of the award winners from the past. Tell me if you think that if any of these guys are any interesting names for you. Isaac Austin, Don McLean, Helen Henderson, Daryl Armstrong, Bobby Simmons, Aaron Brooks, Ryan Anderson, Scott Skiles. That's a George Mirson, but nobody will slander that most improved player. Nobody will slander that man on this podcast. Yeah, I mean, it is sort of weird how we just kind of award this, I guess because we feel like the MVP is for Jokic-level players, but I don't know, I kind of agree with this. Like, what the jump to being that good is meaningful. Now, is the real question to me is Nikola Jokic the best example of this? You know, why? So here's the question, like, why not Joel Embiid for that sort of honor? Perhaps he improved more. And you could go down the list of different guys, I mean, that are on this, you know, that are here. Like, why Jokic over any of those players? And, you know, especially when you consider what Ben was saying, that I think does have some truth to it, that, like, Jokic has kind of won the long game because guys have gotten hurt to some degree. What do you say to that, Matt?
Well, first, I want to say that I think politics are going to play into it. If Jokic wasn't kind of winning the MVP, but by default, I think you would see a lot more buzz for him towards most improved player. But as far as Embiid goes, I think if you're not going to vote for him for MVP because he's missed half the season, I don't think you should vote for him for most improved player because he's missed half the season either.
Okay, fair enough. What about... I'm just looking down the list of potential MVP candidates. I mean, that you could have considered.
Just so we're clear, Joel Embiid's played 49 games. He's going to end up playing something to the effect of like 52 to 53 of the 72. So okay, he did miss more than half the season. Yeah. And he did miss half the season when he should have won the Rookie of the Year over Malcolm Brogdon. But that's neither here nor there.
I was thinking Kevin Durant has missed more that's than fair. Half the season. But either way, yeah. I think if you're going to disqualify him from MVP, the same logic applies.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
I suppose. What about Luka Doncic?
Has Luka really? I just don't think Luka's taken a huge leap over last year. I think he would have had a better argument to say he was most improved last year with his sophomore leap. I know that people don't vote that way. That's just kind of there's a stigma against it. But
okay, fair enough. What about Donovan Mitchell? What about Rudy Gobert? What about Kyrie Irving? Now, I'm being like intentionally obtuse here a little bit, but I think my point is mostly
top 20 guys that are.
But that's sort of my
higher. Yeah,
that's sort of my point. Like, there are there are several players, and you know, Jokic is an interesting case. I mean, you mentioned the 3-point shooting. Also, conditioning wise, he's just so much in better shape. I mean, the fact that he is the most durable of all of these players, and he is playing the heaviest minutes, is in and of itself a form of improvement for him.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one common denominator between Joel and Jokic is they both came into this year in the best shape of. Look, there's a reason why Joel was able to come back from his knee injury as well in a quicker time frame and not suck when he came back or have to get into shape because he was in shape. And mm-hmm. I definitely think that, you know, there's a maturity relationship to both these guys finding what the right body frame for them to succeed is. And I mean, to Jokic's credit, durability is a huge ability. And he's played, you know, significant minutes. He's also a different type of focal point. He's like the combination of, we said this before, but Mike, I think he's like the, you know, 4.0 of like Chris Webber when he was on the Kings. You know, he is the focal point of the offense. It runs through him. The ball's in his hands for decision-making at all times, but he has the extra layer of being, you know, having to play his defense from a center position and not, you know, in Chris Webber's case with, playing, you know, more of a forward position. So
he's kind of like this 15.0 of Chris Webber.
Sure. But Chris Webber's a Hall of Famer and was a great player. So it's like,
it's more just that everybody is the 15.0 version of a guy from 2001. Before I let Billy speak, I know Billy is wanting to talk. Matt, do you have anyone else you'd like to advocate for any award?
Not in particular. I don't really have I don't really have any good arguments to back anyone else up. I just thought that Jokic for most improved was a fun one to at least do the thought experiment on. So I wanted to bring that up.
Yes.
I like it. Thank you. I like it. I do agree with the larger point. We need more superstars winning that award. But if you took it literally, but yes. Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Billy.
Hey guys.
Billy, what's up?
All right, so I know we talked about MVP a little bit earlier, but I'm going to make the case for Steph.
Yes, and, let's do it. I'm okay. With this one.
So here's kind of the cornerstone of my argument. It's that the kind of curve of like the marginal value of a win this year is parabolic, where it peaks like it peaks in the middle of it, like getting to the 45 plus win, the 45-ish win area this year. Or no, sorry, 45 over an 82-game schedule.
Right, so, I know what you mean.
Yeah, a little bit over 500. Yeah, it's hard. That's the most difficult. Those getting to that level is most difficult wins, controlling for kind of competition, considering all the pandemic environment, and especially seeing like what Utah's doing this year, what Milwaukee did the past couple of years, where you can kind of just implement a regular season formula, get a lot of wins, I don't want to call them cheap wins, but you can there's a formula to being a 66 win team, even if you're not really that like plus 14 net rating team that is kind of an all-time great team. Part of the argument make sense? Where
I gotta be honest, I'm not really following you on this one.
Okay,
I have to be honest. If I'm doing, right. I'm sort of lost on where you're going with this.
All right, so going to Steph, I'm just trying to basically argue out if Steph and Jokic have kind of on a permanent basis have been as good on the court, and the difference is that Jokic's team has more wins, partially because he's played more, partially because of the quality of his teammates. And an additional win this year isn't as difficult because of the pandemic circumstances and because the regular season matters less in general over the past couple of years. I think that part of the argument benefiting Jokic isn't as effective anymore.
I see. So you're basically saying that like the win difference shouldn't matter as much this year. I don't entirely buy what you're saying in terms of the pandemic. Are you just saying that because like there are just more schedule losses and whatever?
Yeah, there's more schedule losses. Like I think just there's less enthusiasm because of the lack of fans. I think, and then the just play-in. Overall,
the play-in game too. Opening it up to 10 teams, each conference doesn't have 10 teams that are worth a damn, and let alone 11 to make the 10th one push itself. So that adds to this as well. Yeah,
exactly. And that was kind of where I was trying to hint at like the parabolic, where those kind of the 8 through, or I guess now 7 through 10 or 7 through 11 spots, those wins are so much more difficult because there's so much more focus on them versus when you, as you like go to the right, as you're approaching the 4-5-3-2 seeds, those aren't, I mean, relative to kind of prior years where there wasn't the play-in, those wins are easier than.
Okay.
So what Steph's doing in getting in single-handedly dragging an offense to the team to a team in those more difficult, in that more difficult bucket of wins at plus and dragging what I think we all kind of recognize is one of the least talented rosters. We literally saw them be the second worst team in the NBA last year without him in a very similar roster.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think also the players that we're seeing right now are inflated. Like we all know the Steph gravity charts of what players' true shooting increases when he's on the court versus when he's not. I just think that if you pull Steph off that team, especially considering, where like if you pull stuff off that team, they're even worse, and the slot is more impressive because of the competition around the play-in spot this year. I know that wasn't the most beautifully crafted argument, but I feel like my at least some of my sentiments got across there.
Okay, So I guess that means that if you're the key to being an MVP candidate is to make your team just good enough to be in the play-in picture, but not quite good enough to be out of the play-in picture. I'm messing with you, but
no, I mean Steph's not the GM. I mean, everything's a product of circumstances.
Yeah, okay. Right. So, but then why wouldn't Jokic's team could very easily have fallen into that picture. Why is Jokic not getting valued for leading his team out of that picture?
Because his teammates are better.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, look, his teammates certainly are better. Well, I mean, let me put it this way. I am very sympathetic to Steph as MVP cases. This one is causing me to think a little bit.
Whenever we think about MVP, I think, why does baseball kind of have it so easy each year? And they've got like better catch-all statistics. And so I'm trying to think, what are the ways to kind of isolate just pure player performance? And again, like, I guess MVP is this very subjective argument where like, we're not even sure what we're voting for each year because value is so subjective. But I don't know. I'm just trying to think which player has done the most for their team this season, which is even less of a precise definition. And
baseball is also fun because they don't have to make hard decisions in general, not just the statistics, but they have one for each league, and then they get to actually split up offense and defense in for, you know, Silver Slugger and Golden Glove, so that they can look at things in a very specific way. We obviously have all defense in the NBA and then all NBA in general, but those are not two sides of different coins.
But that's also the beauty of basketball, is it's a continuous game with free flowing. And that's sort of what you're describing, I think, is less about the award and more about the unique element of basketball.
I think there's definitely some like Iverson parallels to just in the most opposite type of basketball player. Like, I'm not comparing the way that each of them approaches the game of basketball, but Iverson carried a team of players who were objectively probably couldn't get to 50, 60 points a game without someone like him on that team. They built a specific roster around him, and he carried them to a number one seed into the NBA Finals in a very different era in the game. Steph right now has essentially figured out how to will with Draymond. And it's very important to understand that Draymond is, like, you know, doing absolutely everything he can to make sure Steph is in the optimal position given the players they have around him. And Draymond,
except for score himself,
except
when he's
for
open.
Shooting and scoring,
kind of important.
But he's just like a moving lead blocker at all times, like constantly seeking out the right way to get Steph open, and no one else on the team really does anything of that nature. Like, I just love the. I, you know, having watched probably maybe 10 Golden State, maybe a couple more than 10 here on the West Coast, I do catch quite a lot of West Coast hoops now. But when you watch Steph and Golden State play, like, any given game, their second leading scorer, it could be one of like six players, you know, legitimately one of six guys, of which three usually come off the bench, you know. And so, not to mention they had to deal with playing with Kelly Oubre, and that can't be fun. For anyone, you know,
it's a bad team. It's a bad team. Well, you know, Wiseman's actually an interesting one, just because Wiseman was entirely played because of his future potential, and as a present value day player, he was incredibly not valuable this year.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, sorry, I'm just seeing on Twitter. Ethan Rothstein, our friend, says any voter that puts Steph number one in 2015 and will again in 2021. Should have a serious self-reflection period. I assume that's a reference to Harden and how Steph won because of team quality over Harden. Can't say I buy that one. I think there's some slight differences, let's just say, in that logic there. I don't really see that one. I mean, Harden in 2015 would probably beat Jokic, so this is sort of like a silly conversation. Like, the candidates are who they are each year. You know, and my feeling, I guess the logic being like the one man team element, but like you said it too, like the one man team element of Steph is not the same thing as the one man team element of a Harden or a Westbrook. It's in some ways more terrifying, I think, because there, when Harden has the ball, like that's where he does all what he does. Steph, you get that effect when he's literally running.
Yeah, and also, who's done this off of an injury? What's the correlation to an off, like a missed season into an MVP candidacy? I'm curious about that too.
Well, I have to look at the NBA MVPs. I mean, I feel like there are more cases of that, or there will be this than there are. If they aren't yet, there will be more cases, because I imagine that on some level the rest from that injury and the long pandemic has helped. I mean, sure. I certainly think it's helped like Kyrie Irving's season, just as an example. But anyway, Billy, anything else to add about Steph? I mean, I'm sympathetic to the idea that, first of all, like, kind of statistically, like, he's just as good, if not better, than he was when he won the MVP. Of course, everyone's stats are better. You made a good case of the impact. I do think there is some case to be made that, like, the relative difference between a 4 seed and an 8 seed is not that significant. I'm not sure I would have made it exactly how you made it, but I understand where you were kind of going with that. And then just, I mean, to me, it's about the terror he inspires. Is there any other case for Steph?
That was going to be kind of just the last thing I brought up, where the movement is singularly unique in the NBA and maybe in NBA history. And I'm just not sure we're anywhere close to be able to quantify that issue or that impact, where you make a feint the wrong way and he's got 3 inches and suddenly you're either up or down 3 more or less points. And just kind of that expectation of perfection that you have to have on defense to guard him. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we're anywhere close to having to guard that, to quantify that. Though I think you can say the same thing about Jokic with his passing and the areas on the floor from which he passes. So that wasn't the one I was going to lean on. But I just think the style in which Steph plays and allows Draymond to be kind of weirdly a plus offensive contributor because he's so good at playing with Steph. And then obviously the spacing that's provided, that he provides for guys who would otherwise provide negative spacing. I'm just not sure we can quantify all that. So even looking at all like the alphabet soup of catch-all metrics, I'm not sure. I'm still not positive that they fully quantify Steph's offensive impact.
I am with you 100%. And I mean, to me, it's almost less about what he does to his teammates. It's more about sort of the psychological toll on defenders that kind of gets reflected in other places in the game, that you can't necessarily draw a very simple one-to-one kind of causation correlation like you could with something like Jokic's passes, where it's like kind of a rotation is missed here or you're selling out more here. I do think that there's a lot there that psychologically impacts what's going on. What's the old Albert Einstein truism? Not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts. You ever heard that one?
No, that
sounds right. You should have attributed that to yourself, because I never heard it.
Albert Einstein. I read it. You know, I knew the quote, but there's a really good Ringer story today by Zach Cram about how analytics are struggling to measure defense, and it included that quote in there, and that reminded me of it. But anyway, that's a good case. You know, I've been riding the Steph MVP train really all season, if you really look at my history. Like, even before this stretch, I kind of made similar arguments. That's why I said I'm with you on the argument. I'm not sure I would have made it the same way. So, very interesting. Do you have any other award cases you would like to make?
Yeah, Scott Brooks, Coach of the Year. No other team.
I hate you so much. I hate you so much.
No other team had a 19-day break, and he still put his team ahead of his teammate.
I can't believe it. The almost is almost worse than saying Russell Westbrook for MVP.
Wizards party, baby, goes on.
Yeah, I should have said that we're allowing any argument to be made here except for Scott Brooks and Russell Westbrook. Those are prohibited.
Would you bet your life that he hasn't signed an extension?
I wouldn't bet my life. Okay. You know.
That's obviously 100% facetious. Like, if this causes you stress, then feel free to kick me off the stage.
No, it's okay. This thing shouldn't cause me stress. Let's just say that the thought has crossed my mind, even if I don't think it's actually happened. So, fair enough. Okay. Anybody else? I know I don't see any other speaker requests. Does anybody who's in the chat want to make an argument for their favorite player or coach to win an award?
Going once.
Okay. Anybody mm-hmm. want to make a case? Ben, you want to make a case for someone to win an award? That is not Joel Embiid. We're not talking about Joel Embiid.
Yeah. No. Matisse Thybulle should be the defensive player of the year in the NBA. It shouldn't be Gobert, because Gobert is going to end up winning it because the Jazz need to get something thrown to them for their tremendous regular season that they've just had. Gobert fits every mold of, again, if we can't quantify properly in analytics defensive value, somehow everyone finds a way to do that for Rudy Gobert. And so I will tell you that he's going to end up winning it. And Matisse Thybulle should probably be all defensive first team, and I hope he gets it. I've never seen anyone really play defense like him. He's like a free safety in a man zone, in a man scheme in football, meaning that he's playing both an area and a player at all times. He has a savant nature to the way he can gauge space and time, as well as his ability to recoup space on the court when he is beat. The guy's kind of just like, again, he's a savant at defense. Now, that being said, I did see Gobert last night in an interesting type of format with a team who was trying to bring him away from the paint, and he was ineffective. Like, I think we've seen the Rudy Gobert song and dance, and so I'm going to tell you that Ben Simmons is the one who's going to win the award. Matisse should probably finish in the top five and get defensive first team. And then every NBA nerdo journalist can look at each other, smile, and pat each other on the back when they give Gobert another defensive player of the year. So that's what
I'll be doing just that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course, because he's super important to winning regular season games against the Thunder 15 times a year. So
I believe it is a regular season award, Ben.
I couldn't agree more, man. And I think that it's, both we've already talked about that, as you mentioned the article that you read today, and I agree completely that it's very difficult to put the analytics behind defense to make both an argument but also to specifically to show value. And I think with Gobert, he somehow is bigger than that, because everyone points to a bajillion different basketball sabermetrics of how he can affect the game, even though he does it from a singular spot. He does it from the paint. I watched him routinely.
Less singular this year. I mean, the curve of Steph Curry is like kind of a hard curve to measure. Like it's like saying that Ben Simmons isn't the defensive player of the year because one time Luka Doncic scored a lot of points on him.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I get there's part of it is putting yourself on a specific player instead of having players funneled to you where you jump up straight and vertical. And he's great at that. Look, Gobert's a great player for people who want to think of themselves as basketball intellectuals, because he checks off a lot of boxes.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Fake intellectuals like me. Yeah. Me, that's fake right, intellectual. Like
I thought about this a lot. I think the defensive team this year, I would love to see just like a plethora of these kind of like wings that are the new age. Like, give me Bridges on there.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It is obviously, right?
Oh yeah.
Find a way. Yeah, totally, man. Find a way to get Nerlens Noel onto one of these teams. He's been exceptional for the Knicks this year.
That's an interesting one.
Second team.
That's an interesting one. I think there is something to that.
Yeah. Look, I think he's like a poor man's Gobert, and then how people should be looking at him. But he's also someone who came into this year with rather low expectations. He was sort of a fringe late signing. He has had to fill in for a. Now, again, Mitchell Robinson was supposed to be the man in the middle there, and has gotten hurt like three different times, and then the season-ending injury. And so Nerlens has done a great job, and that's freed up a lot of the offensive ability for Randall and for the team in general. It's really, really hard to play Thibs' defensive system night in and night out. Nerlens has been great. So I'd like to see him get some proper rub here as well for one of these all-defensive teams. I think he's fully earned at least to be thought of in that type of regard as one of the best, if not best, rim protectors in the league. He's fantastic. So always been a fan of Nerlens. Glad he's doing well. That's one of the kind of out there ones I had.
Matt asked you, are you picking, is your serious defensive player that you pick Simmons?
Yeah, it is. It is Ben.
Okay.
My serious defensive player of the year is Ben, and I'm fully prepared for Gobert to win it. And obviously, he's a more than I'm just being critical for the hell of it. But he's obviously more than a more than willing person to get the award. My coach of the year. I'm going back and forth. I'm blown away by the Knicks being as competitive and good as they are. And I do understand the initial rub that Tibbs gives teams structure. You know, again, he's made them a significantly better team. I still think I'm leaning towards Monty Williams though. Cause I love Monty Williams as a person. He was great as an assistant coach in Philly. And it's very hard to overlook that the Suns, again, obviously getting Chris Paul helps. Having a healthy Ayton who wasn't suspended for, was it steroids? Is that what he took?
A diabetic, helps right? A lot. Or
Is that what it was?
Diuretic. That's the word. Not diabetic.
Yeah. No, he's not. He's not. He did not take diabetic.
Diuretic.
just spiking his insulin. So I'm leaning towards Monty. But like, yeah, I let me ask you this. Why not Quinn Snyder?
That's a good question. Why not? Why not Quinn Snyder? I don't know why he's not coach of the year. It's a good question.
I don't hear the buzz around him as much. They've dealt with a number of injuries. They've kind of made the most of career, call it role guys like Ingles and Clarkson. I'm curious if you think that he ends up sneaking in there. Who do you think is going to win that coach of the year award?
I would think Monty Williams is going to win, but you know, you make a good case for Snyder. I think, you know, a lot of times, I mean, the problem with coach of the year is very similar to the problem with, most improved. It's sort of like the who surprised us the most rather than who did the best coaching job. And the Suns are a much better team than we all thought. And that's sort of fueling a lot of Chris Paul's fringe MVP candidacy right now, which look, I mean, I understand where it comes from, but we can appreciate how great he's been without doing that. I mean, I'm a little more sympathetic to it than most, let's just say, but it's still not happening. But Quinn Snyder, I mean, the Jazz have been good before, and so now they're just better good. That seems less impressive. Yeah. I'm going to throw out a left field name for Coach of the Year. Why not Nate McMillan?
Yeah, that's an interesting one for sure. Talk about in-season difference. I mean, the Hawks, and this is one of the weird things, too, about this whole wild season. It coincided with injuries too. Like he took over as Reddish and what's his name from UVA, now I'm blanking on his name, we just came back last night. Come on, Mike, it's like in the second year.
Wait, so the guy from you or whatever. From who, from UVA, where? I'm sorry. Oh, DeAndre Hunter
I'm sorry, from Philadelphia to UVA. I forget that. As these guys were going down, he was taking over. And yeah, that's one where you get to see an in-season correlation between one coach and another. That's fascinating. McMillan's done a great job with them. I just think that there's probably going to be some, you know, as you mentioned, a top tier team, one of the teams that finishes first or second. And I think in the Knicks case, finishing with home court advantage should get Tibbs some votes as well.
Which is not guaranteed. I mean, it's not guaranteed.
No, it's not. I mean, look, there's a big thing happening in the Eastern Conference playoffs, quick aside, which is that, like, if the Heat stay in that sixth spot and you get a Knicks-Hawks 4-5, like, you're going to have a Knicks or Hawks in the second round of the playoffs.
Well, more importantly,
which is a huge leap for a young...
More importantly, you're going to have potentially the Bucks having to face the Heat again.
That's which is just, yeah, I think we all want that, too. I would love to see that. A world where the Knicks either get a leap out of nowhere into the second round of the playoffs, or the Hawks take a premature, but ultimately people thought they were on the way up, with a young team. Like that's a huge get for either one of those teams, to stay in the 4-5 and to get each other in the first round. And then, selfishly, it'd be great for the Sixers to get one of those two teams in the second round instead of the Heat as well. So
yeah, you know, a lot of positioning,
a
lot of positioning. Yeah. By the way. Yeah. So there's one element of the Nate McMillan case that you have not mentioned, which is, the value over coaching replacement between Nate McMillan and Nate Bjorken appears to be quite high. doesn't that help Nate McMillan's case? Like, I mean, if we're gonna say that, like, sort of, it's use the MVP argument where it's like, look at what happens to the team when he's not there. Surely that has to play some role, does it not?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it, too. So it's not just the Lloyd Pierce replacement. It's the Bjorkman replacement. Indiana, few things. But, like, I think losing, number one, being part of that middle playoff pack where nothing mattered for the last month for them, definitely did not help an unmotivated basketball team. injuries certainly haven't helped, with Turner getting hurt. Sabonis was hurt. LeVert was out for a long time after the trade. They did make an in-season big trade. So I don't think it's been the easiest path for a new head coach. But, man, talk about losing your team. Losing the locker room, losing the bench, losing your assistant coaches mid-game. That's a great example as well. I feel like now, maybe Nate McMillan is becoming an underappreciated head coach. Maybe already has.
Now, I'm being a little facetious because obviously Nate McMillan didn't choose his own replacement. We're being a little silly here, but it's just throwing that out there. Just throwing it out there. Now, I think the best thing that the Hawks got back was not Nate McMillan, but it was a healthy Bogdan Bogdanovic. But if I'm going to make a case against my own case, Matt says Nash might get some votes for wrangling the Stars. That would be kind of interesting, given I guess he did wrangle them, but I think injuries may have wrangled them quite effectively. But that's okay. That's interesting. That is sort of an interesting spin on the value of a coach. Is your job in the regular season to win the most, or is it to sort of survive without any drama?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess it's to win the most with the least amount of drama. So maybe it's a little bit of both. But sometimes drama is good. Like, this is the thing. Like, sometimes you want to galvanize in some capacity if the season's dragging on. And like, I think about this, what Steve Kerr has done this year. Like, Kerr has kind of fallen on some swords, admitted being wrong a little bit, but without being very explicit. Knowing what he was going to eventually try to get to, which was this, Steph-centric team that could potentially, get into the playoff mix. But, they had plenty of drama. He had lots of people questioning him, questioning everything. And I think Wiseman getting hurt probably helped him the most in terms of how he wanted to coach. He didn't have to, continue to pound the round peg into the square hole. I think there's a couple situations like that.
That's another one.
I also think we haven't mentioned – well, nothing like specific to like exactly like Steph, but look, McCollum went down for a long time this year, and the Trailblazers also had Nurkic down for a long time this year, and that definitely didn't help. They made an in-season trade that may have been a little counterintuitive in Trent.
Worked out.
I'm not sure exactly.
I think it's working pretty well.
I guess.
I think so. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, why not? It wasn't like a blockbuster, but so I think that's another situation where Stotts has done a deceptively good job at figuring out multiple teams within a single season.
Well, maybe Stotts should tell his bosses that, because obviously the big rumor is that this is probably it for him.
So it's going to be crazy when he ends up in Milwaukee next year, right? That's the most logical place for him.
Yeah. Well, how about this? Coach Bud is coach of the year because he changed the most. Who cares that they haven't won as many games, but he's addressed his weaknesses the most.
What about Doc Rivers? We haven't mentioned Doc yet. He changes the least. Doc never changes a damn thing. But it has somehow gotten a heck of a lot more out of Joel and Ben's pairing together, a lot more out of Tobias Harris. I don't think he deserves to win Coach of the Year, because I think the Sixers have a good team and had a good foundation. And I think a lot of it has to do with just getting the right pieces around Joel. But you can say something. If you watch the Sixers play with Brett Brown for a number of years, and then you watch them play with Doc, like they're a better team, for lack of in-game adjustments, but they're a better team for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So, fair enough. Yeah. All right. Yeah. You got anybody else?
Let's see. Sixth man of the year, we haven't talked about that much, because it seems like it's going to be one of the two Utah guys, and they're probably – they probably are very deserving. They both are having
Jalen Brunson. Jalen Brunson.
Yeah, I like
Jalen Brunson. Deserves some love.
Yeah, I like Jalen Brunson a lot. I also have been really, again, not another Knicks thing, but like Derrick Rose has been fantastic.
Yeah,
he's definitely been one of the best trades of the deadline.
Thaddeus Young, good call from Matt. Has he started too many games to be eligible? I never understand what the threshold for this award is.
Yeah. He has been great, though. Love Thad. Always going to be a Thad fan.
Thad has started 20 of his 64 games. That's close. That's tight. I'm going to say Miles Bridges. Has he started too many games? If not, I think he deserves some love.
Yeah.
18 out of 64. Yeah, I'm going to say Miles Bridges. Give me some Miles Bridges. If for nothing else, because he has inspired Eric Collins, the Hornets announcer, to some wonderful heights this year. You know, you got to get him some love for that. Eric Collins. And then I have another hipster choice, which is not going to actually be the case. But why not Jae Sean Tate for Rookie of the Year?
Interesting. Yeah, he's been great. I maybe it's because nothing on Houston is going to get anything. Rookie of the Year is going to be obviously, I think the most compelling part is going to be to see what the vote difference is between LaMelo and Edwards. And I think Haliburton deserves some votes as well. He was great.
Yeah. Tail off a little bit.
Top, but... I'm just kidding. Yeah, he did.
But
we don't need to joke about Obi-Toppin too.
The Edwards thing is interesting, right? So if you look at Edwards' season as like the sum of his whole season, you know, he was really bad at the beginning for half the year and has really come on in a way that Haliburton has sort of stayed level most of the year and LaMelo got hurt. But the Anthony Edwards we're seeing right now, I think is like potentially like we're looking at the beginning of the next great perimeter player in the sport. I'm not saying he's there yet, but like surely the value of being that level of a player, do you give added weight to that? Or do you say, well, it's only been at the end of the year. The beginning of the year still counts and we can't give him that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I did see someone posted, like, since the All-Star break, which teams have, and I forget what the metric was, but essentially played the best basketball comparatively to the first half. And Minnesota's way up there. Like, they've played much better basketball, and obviously having Kat back was a huge part of this. But, like, and I look at Anthony Edwards and I think, like, shit, his athleticism is boundless. His shot will get better and better and better. And he seems to carry himself in a way that makes people like him. He has the right personality set to be like a likable universal superstar. And I'm not saying LaMelo doesn't. I think LaMelo is incredible. I think he's going to win the Rookie of the Year, and rightfully so. He makes the Hornets significantly better.
Is it rightfully so? Okay. I want to think about this a little bit. Now, LaMelo Ball is like a thrill. Thrill to watch.
He's great.
I think, and I have thought all season, and I think it showed in a lot of stretches when he's been out, that LaMelo Ball's singular impact on the Charlotte Hornets this season is slightly overrated. They have a lot of good players.
Other guys, yeah, Rozier made a leap. Then they had Graham when he was out to step up.
Gordon Hayward, I think, had a really good year before he got hurt. I think the biggest reason that Charlotte is in the position they're in is not necessarily the injury to LaMelo Ball, but it's that Ball and Gordon Hayward got hurt at the same time.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
I'm just wondering if like maybe LaMelo is riding a glow of credit in Charlotte that should be spread around more.
Yeah, I guess. It's just easier to appreciate. I think two things at play here. Both of those guys are great. I think Edwards and LaMelo could be 1-2 picks in many drafts. I think next year's draft is going to be scrutinized in a similar sense because Cade Cunningham and Jalen Green are both ridiculous, and there's some other great prospects too. But these two seem like generational type players. Obviously, Wiseman being the second pick in there and who knows? We're not writing the book on him yet. He's super young, but he certainly plays a position that is less of a premium than your all-world athletic wing and your 6'8", transformational point guard. But I also think that with LaMelo, there's this other thing. Is it the spotlight? Like, Edwards played, a half a season of SEC basketball at a non-Tier 1 SEC basketball program in Georgia. And LaMelo has been in the public limelight, under public scrutiny for – since he was 14, 15, 13, something like that, right? So, people wanted to watch, a lot of people, for better or for worse, wanted to watch him fail because of that, because his father, because of the reality television aspects to him. And all he did was make everyone like him, and everyone liked watching him play. And so I think he had to change public perception in a way that other rookies will never have to do, just because no other rookie is going to have that type of, background. And in Edwards' case, he played college basketball during a pandemic season at a program that's on, you know, ESPN two times a year when they play against Kentucky, you know. And so, like, I just think there's just like a very different way that both of them came at this. And then in Edwards' case also, to have such a good second half of the year, once his team got a little healthier, once he could start to find an identity, you know, with his running mate, if you will, in Karl-Anthony Towns. I think there's a great case to be made that the ceiling that we're seeing from him could be higher than LaMelo, but that they both have exceptional futures, and that LaMelo's single season this year was just probably, you know, strong enough throughout to give him the nod.
So Anthony Edwards, in this, after the All-Star break this year, which is about 32 games compared to 36 beforehand, 23.5 points a game, 5.6 rebounds, 3.3 assists, 56 true shooting, which is about average now for the league, but it was 46.6, which is like dreadful beforehand, you know, shooting 35% from three, which is a major improvement. Again, like, yeah, it's, I mean, it's half the year, but that half the year, that half the year is better than anything LaMelo has produced the whole year. And it's just, I don't know.
Ben Simmons for rookie
of the year. That's funny.
But
my hips are, choice.
I have a question real quick though. Like, just cause I love prodding it at Jazz fans, but like, do you think part of the reason why they take the superlative awards so seriously and like shit matters 4 years later is because they've never won anything as a franchise?
I'm not going to answer that.
No,
I'm not going to answer.
Like, you know,
who started the Ben Simmons Donovan Mitchell rookie of the year beef?
Dude, you know who started that?
Mitchell started it?
And Adidas, dude. It was a fucking Adidas campaign.
Was it Adidas? Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah, that sounds right, though.
You could buy the shirts. I mean, like, you know, that was, it was, yeah, anyhow, that, it's all, there's always a marketer behind these things. The truth is that I like Mitchell a lot, and Simmons is like a pretty quiet dude. He's, you know, he's not some ostentatious superstar, you know, putting his name out there and all things. Does he root for himself to win the Defensive Player of the Year? Yeah, he's certainly putting himself out there for that award because I think he wants it and deserves it. I'm a huge Donovan Mitchell fan. I'm still, I mean, of all the players from the Jazz, I like Connolly a lot. You go down the list of players that I'm big fans of. So, you know, other than the one who took the pandemic unseriously and tried to spread it to people on purpose.
Okay. Even when you say something nice about a player on the Jazz, you can't help yourself. I'm rooting for them to win the title to shut you up forever.
Buddy, a world where the Jazz and Sixers end up playing in the finals, or the Nuggets and Sixers, just so I can get these matchups. And I like Jokic and I like Denver, so I'd actually prefer the Sixers if the Nuggets make the finals, for the Sixers to, you know, if they happen to lose, I would be rooting hard for the Nuggets to win the championship. Great fan base. Happy Adam Morris is great. Big fan of him as a person. And so I would love to see the Nuggets succeed and Jokic succeed. There's nothing against them. I don't want to put them in the same bucket. But a Jazz Sixers final would be appetizing, to say the least.
Jazz and Knicks, place your bets. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're at about an hour. We need some more.
Does anybody else want to make some take? I thought semi-seriously to make the Mikal Bridges for Defensive Player of the Year argument, and just I don't think he's the, it's again like kind of a silly argument, but screw it. You know, when you can cover all sorts of different players, lock them up from the wing, I just like that guy,
he's great, man. Nova Nation, big fan. You know, can't lie, it still hurts that the Sixers traded him away for Zaire Smith. It is what it is. All roads lead to where we are now. I'm trying to think other players we haven't talked about much this year, or who have been great this year or deserve a little bit of shine. I don't know. I think we've kind of hit a wall. We needed some input. We didn't get it. You know, it is what it is. We try to solicit some questions and you don't get it. Give me your actual, if you can, and you don't, it could be subject to change, but what's your actual awards look like? If I were to say coach, defense, and sixth man and most improved.
Do I want him? say Steph for MVP. I've been like riding that all year. I don't know if I can do it. Yeah, whatever. Sure. I don't have a real vote. Okay. I think it's pretty close between him and Jokic. I don't really care who wins. Where are we at? Coach of the year. I would probably go with Monty Williams. Tell me what defensive player of the year I go with, because I'm an unsophisticated, nerdy blogger who wants to feel smart, according to Ben. I'm going to go with Rudy Gobert. What are the other awards? Most improved, probably Julius Randle by default. Yep. Although that's an award that I would think more about and kind of consider exactly where I'm going with that. The Jokic case that was made earlier in the pod was kind of interesting. Good. It was an interesting one. It made me think a little bit. But I think ultimately it's probably Randle. Although the question I guess that you have with him is like, is his most improved case mostly kind of buttressed by this amazing shooting that he's doing that's unsustainable from 2-point range? It's a real, I think it's an interesting.
And 3-point, man. He's raised his 3-point percentage like 20 points this year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but maybe he's just like, Julius Randle's always been kind of I don't know. I've always liked his game. I always thought he could be like an even more offensively gifted like Thad. He's just like a lefty who can get left whenever he wants, but his shooting is incredible.
It's so funny you say that. I hated watching him play last year. He was my least favorite player to watch. I just thought it, you focus on all the wrong things. And then like the transformation has been remarkable.
So maybe maybe just answered your own question right there.
Maybe. Well, you know. I mean, the other interesting candidate is Michael Porter Jr.
Yo, yeah. We can wait on him, because then next year when he makes the jump into a top 20 player in the league, then we can give him that award, because he's probably going to do that. I had to guess.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, some of the other guys to think about for some of, what do we got? Six man. I think Joe Ingles has been the sixth man over Jordan Clarkson by a fairly substantial margin, but I would go with Jalen Brunson and Mikal Bridges as my non-Jazz six men. I think Mikal Bridges deserves a lot more love than he gets. What do we got? What else we got? Rookie of the year. I think I'd probably go with Ball in the End, but I would think about it.
Yeah. Like, and coach of the year. You did coach of the year. Sorry, you already did that. Yeah. You said, okay. Yep.
Okay. I want to try to slip like D'Anthony Melton, I think, deserves some six man love. I guess like the question of sort of, there's a question of defensive player of the year if you don't give it to Gobert or Simmons is kind of an interesting one. Like, what about Clint Capella? What about, you know, I just think it's also interesting, you know, what about Drew Holiday? Like, I know the Bucks defense isn't what it was, but, you know, is there some case to be made that he deserves that sort of honor?
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know. And as far as like sort of fringe MVP candidates that I think deserve maybe a little bit more love than they're getting, I think I've been riding the Steph train all season. No question. I think Luka Doncic is maybe getting a little overlooked in this conversation. I would say I'm also like kind of very sympathetic to the Gobert for MVP talk. I know you probably won't be.
That's just, yeah. Okay.
Why is that ridiculous? Is that ridiculous? You tell me.
I mean, you find me an MVP candidate who's ever averaged, what is he average? 12 points a game?
Like, who cares?
You can't overvalue defense to undervalue offense. The MVP should be the best player in the league.
He's a great offensive player too. He just doesn't score.
I'm not giving secondary screen assists the same type of credit that everyone, again, that some parts of the NBA community do. Like,
it's not bad though. It's not screen assists. It's that he allows the Jazz to play the way they play, like fundamentally.
Then you can't put him ahead of like. Okay, so let me say this. Embiid is better at defense than Gobert is at offense, and Embiid is so much better at offense. Not so much. Embiid is better at offense than Gobert is at defense. That's the way
I would have Embiid ahead of Gobert in the list.
I'm just saying Gobert is the third best center in the league this year, and that's a lot of credit to. That's great. That is a really high watermark to be in a league where the probably top two MVP candidates are centers, right? I think that's a lot of credit given. Yeah.
All right. Let me ask you this then. would you, do you think Rudy Gobert has a better case than the Fox? Like, how would you rate Rudy Gobert's case compared to these guys? Damian Lillard.
Better. Yeah, better.
Do you think his case is better? Okay. Luka Doncic. Mm-hmm.
About on par. What the Mavs have done in the second half of the year, and also they deconstructed their roster to be less supportive of Doncic this offseason. And
not on purpose.
Took them a little while to figure. No, not on purpose. But that's what happened. Josh Richardson and didn't make them better than Seth Curry did. Hardaway's given them very little, and KP has just been a walking injury. Who knows? We'll have a podcast on Porzingis another day to kind of figure out his career trajectory and that arc. But yeah, on par, they're close.
Giannis.
Go with Giannis. Bucks still having a really good year. Giannis still putting up absurd stats. Two way god, and ultimately, like, they're probably just as good odds to win the NBA title this year as they were last year.
Okay. What about all the Nets?
Yeah. None of the Nets. Kyrie having the best, argument to be made. He's been great, and I'll tell you, like, I think I've said this in the pod for years, but like, I absolutely love watching Kyrie play. I hate having to defend Kyrie to my friends who can't see the forest through the trees or whatever it is, to just like watch this savant with a ball play basketball, and then always bring up the way he talks outside of it. But what he's done through Ramadan too is just incredible. Like, I
got it.
I have so much respect for that. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess more players should fast to help their MVP cases.
Buddy, I look, you and I are Jewish, and we fast on Yom Kippur.
I know. It's still amazing. I know you're, I'm just making fun. All right. Last couple, Chris Paul. Yeah. What? Yeah. I don't understand how you can have Chris Paul in the conversation, but not Rudy Gobert.
Yeah. Oh, you do. I mean, look, I'm totally down for Gobert to be in the conversation. And in fact, if he ends up being, call it, fifth in overall MVP voting, he's been the best player on the best team in the NBA. That's probably
That's all I'm saying.
And that's fair. Yeah. And at the end of the day, I'm not here to just shit on Gobert. I think he's like a generational defensive player who absolutely deserves to be in this conversation for being the anchor of the best team in the NBA for, I don't know, how long have the Jazz had the best record in the NBA? More or less.
The whole season.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I know Billy wants to talk, and I want to give him a chance. But the last thing I'll say about Gobert before you go, just think about this. He is the inverse Steve Nash.
Yeah. Okay. Let me marinate on that a little bit. I have to hop off, but this is fine. I hope. Yes, I got. I know what you were going for.
The inverse Steve Nash. You know that with him, he's the one that makes it all work, and the other guys get the credit. And that would make Donovan Mitchell the inverse Amari Stoudemire. But I'm just going to kind of think that thought through. Just think about that for a second. All right, Billy, what's up?
All right.
Billy, you've been waiting for a while. I feel bad. What's up?
No, all good. I'm glad you guys kind of got to touch on it a little bit. But I was just wondering, who's at this point is your second All-NBA, first team All-NBA guard? I think I've got Luka. I think he's kind of pulled. It's between Luka and Dame for me. And I think he's just kind of pulled a little. He's done a little more heavy lifting with the Dallas roster than Dame has with the Blazers roster. And I think if that's the case, he makes All-NBA guard. There's a world where it's not that difficult of a run. I mean, the West is difficult. It's not inconceivable. They make the West Finals this year. I'm just wondering, like, kind of where do you have Luka in, like, the overall league hierarchy?
What is he actually eligible for again? I mean, the All-NBA stuff is messy because of all these new positional designations that they've created.
I think he's guard forward, and I'm okay with putting him at guard because I feel like he's probably been one of the more heliocentric guys this year, right? Like, Harden really hasn't been doing his step back thing.
Probably the most heliocentric, to be honest.
Yeah.
That's a good. I mean, epistemologically, like, sort of the positional sort of designations, I think this is a tricky thing to figure out because, I mean, I'm writing this book chapter now, but just like positionality is so divorced from size now in a way that never has been, that it's just so hard to really do this in a universal way. My suggestion would be just have height designations. Like,
oh, interesting.
So it doesn't matter what position they are, but you get one guy over 7 feet tall. Just as an example, you get like two players from like 6'8" to 7 feet, and you get two players that are one player that's like 6'7" to 6'4", and one player that's 6'3" or under. I don't know, something along those lines.
Okay, so two questions on that. One, how would you enforce Kevin Garnett and Kevin Durant to use their real heights and not lie?
I'd say you got to take the listed height. So if you list your height as a certain thing, I mean, I don't know how else to do that. But
and two, so is that just kind of reserving vestiges of tradition and, as opposed to ditching positions? Or is this something that's just like you don't think that's ever going to happen, so you're trying to find a compromise?
No, I actually think this is a better way of thinking about it, because the whole like ditching a positions thing, like, again, I'm not giving away too much of this book chapter that I'm doing right now, but I think the idea of the league being positionalist is very misleading. I don't buy that the league is positionalist. Like, I think to me, like, that's just the problem we've had all these years, is that we have only assumed for a long time height was the only differentiator, or size, or whatever sort of proxy you want to give. And now that, like, it's more complicated in saying, is it height? Is it skill level? Is it all that? Like, to say the league is just positionalist is like just sort of throwing our hands up in the air and just sort of operating under what the previous structure was. But the truth is that positionality is like a little bit fluid, but there are players playing positions. Like Nikola Jokic, when he brings the ball up, he is the point guard in function. If you think about like a coach drawing up a clipboard and drawing up a play. Like, we talk a lot about like inverted pick and rolls and all this stuff. Like, from the coach's perspective, they've just changed the positions of the players on that pick and roll.
Mm-hmm.
On that sequence, Draymond Green is the point guard and Steph Curry is the four. Like, it's just, we just don't ever think of it that way, but that is essentially from the, if you're doodling the play on a clipboard, that's how you would do it. Right.
Right.
I mean, you might, for the sake of clarity to your own players, you might not do it that way, but like, essentially that is what's happening on these plays. So, and I think more and more we're seeing like kind of smaller guys play power positions. And so it adds like, but the answer is not to me to make things say that the league is positionless. It's to say that like roles are not size dependent.
Okay.
And maybe change. So that makes sense from like a team perspective. From like a league perspective, though, you can't really make that like kind of the way you designate all NBA positions, right? So to me, the simplest way to do it on a league level is just assume that there's no way to uniformly create positions their spot on a team or even a given possession. Just to make it easier, just give it a height characteristic. And just separate it that way. That way you don't run into the issue of like, is Luka Doncic a point guard? Is he really a small forward? Is like Ben Simmons like a four or a one or a five and all this stuff? Like, whatever Ben Simmons does with his 6'9" frame, like, he's just 6'9". And so you just make it so that that's how you delineate all NBA teams. Instead, just to make it easier, because there are too many factors on a universal level to say, to define positions in that way. Like, positions are, but that's again different than saying that there are no positions. There are clearly positions. Does that make sense? That's why I actually think that is what should happen. Like, make it like a size differentiator.
Okay. Yeah. As a better kind of homage, better reflection on the all NBA teams about how the game is played.
Right. Yeah. So you have to build like a lineup that kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still like rewarding different classes of players. So it's not just like total anarchy, but it's also somewhat flexible in terms of role. So I guess I'm trying to think of like, an all NBA team under that construct would be Steph Curry would very clearly be the one like 6'3" and under guy.
Mm-hmm.
You'd probably still have Embiid or probably Jokic or Embiid as like your 1-7-footer. I'd probably lean Jokic. And then Luka would now suddenly be slotted up into the larger sort of positional construct. Right. because he'd be in that. And then you'd have like Giannis, I guess, is technically 7 feet. I know this gets messy. The real challenge is now you'd have to find somebody who's like 6'7" to 6'4" to put on the All NBA team.
Well, I mean, I think Zach Lowe's been the one who's been hard for this. Where you do like point three wings and a big, so you could do like a six three six four under a 6'5" to 6'10", and then 7 foot and up, or 6'11" and up, or 6'10" right. up, or whatever. Okay. I think that might be a more apt way of, at least in my head, of kind of where a point, a big, and then.
I gotcha. So you basically have one player under like 6'4", one player 7 foot and up, and everybody else is to be between those two poles.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense to me. That's an interesting thought. But okay, fun diversion. To the actual point of All-NBA, I'd have to look at it a little bit closer. It's either Luka or Lillard, you're saying. Is there any other candidate that belongs as a second guard?
Kyrie, Harden, I mean, maybe on a permanent basis, Harden's the best of these guys, but I mean, I don't know how you're going to kind of downgrade him for what he did in Houston, and then obviously missing the past month or so is a knock on his resume.
What about, like, I mean, is Bradley Beal in the picture at all? I mean, do you think about Chris Paul on one of these teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the case. I just think from I personally think from all NBA standpoint, just who's the best,
who's
had the best season. So
I'd have to look at Luka versus Dame a little bit closer. That's an interesting one.
I just think the second guard. I mean, I think kind of a couple of voters have said this, where some fan bases are just going to be absolutely incensed at the players left off of all NBA this year, just because the league is so freaking talented. And there haven't been these huge kind of Kevin Durant and Steph Curry aren't missing this year. Or I'm sure we can go back a year before that, where there's multiple top 10 guys who are kind of erased from the list because of injury.
Right.
It's not as obvious this year who those guys might be. Even if you can't give it to LeBron or Harden or Durant because of missed time.
Yeah, I think I would probably go Luka, and then I would probably go Giannis. And then I guess the question is, do you make Kawhi the guy there as the second forward? Do you still pick LeBron or Durant? That's, I think, where your choices are in that situation. Then second team guard, I think, is where it starts to get kind of interesting. To me, I mean, I think in some order, your all NBA guards or the rest of your guards are probably Kyrie, Bradley Beal, Chris Paul or Devin Booker to pick one, and Donovan Mitchell and Lillard, though. So I don't know. I have to think about this.
You didn't mention Kyrie or Harden in those six.
Yeah. I'm going to leave Kyrie and Harden off for now. I don't know what his missed game is. I think Kyrie has probably got to be there somewhere. I guess Lillard and Kyrie is probably the simplest second team guard. And then you go with, for the third team, I'd probably go with Bradley Beal and Chris Paul for the third team. And then as far as forwards are concerned, I mean, the centers are pretty simple. I think we've kind of talked through that, right? Mm-hmm. The forwards you're looking at, whichever of Kawhi or LeBron or KD, I guess the question is, do you put KD on the list at all? Paul George probably deserves a look. Jimmy Butler's had a really underrated season. I don't think Julius Randle quite got there in the end, but maybe.
And then I think
Tatum. What about Tatum?
Tatum, and then some of the centers are eligible at forward. Like, it's, I know this is those the kind of the first half of the discussion about the wonkiness of how the hell do you sort guys this year. But I mean, if Embiid and Jokic are eligible at forward, then
are they really?
I think that's the case. I think, I think
that, what? Embiid, well, then you would put them both on the first team. There's your answer. Put them with Giannis and have Kawhi and LeBron as your second team forwards, and have Jimmy Butler and Paul George as your third team forwards.
Easy as that.
I guess. But then you have to pick another center. So maybe that's not. See, to me, like this, now we're getting too complicated. Like, let's just make it height designations. That's what I say. That's my fix. Make it delineate all NBA by just height positions. I like your idea of like one short guy, one tall guy, and three medium sized guys. Doesn't matter what their roles are. Doesn't matter how they play. Doesn't matter like sort of their versatility or whatever. Just make it real simple.
I'm there with you.
Okay.
I'm there with you.
All right. So we got a few other people in here now. Does anyone want to make a serious case for Jackson Frank asked about Embiid being forward eligible? I mentioned that. Does anyone want to kind of step up and make a case for a certain person to be involved in the discussion for a certain award? Can be anyone. I will give people a couple seconds and then I'm going to wrap this thing up. I know we've got a lot of new people in here now, but yeah. Bull Bull for Rookie of the Year. That's a fun. I assume that's in reference to something. Like, was he like a Rookie of the Year at some point? A Rookie of the Year candidate, I should say. I've already said my hipster Rookie of the Year would be Jayshon Tate. He will not actually win, but that would be my hipster Rookie of the Year choice. Anybody else got any? Anyone want to sort of put out the case for their favorite player or coach to win their favorite player or their favorite award? Derek Rose for Nate. Derek Rose for Sixth Man. Yeah, Ben actually mentioned that one a little bit earlier in the show. It's an interesting one. I mean, do we give Derek Rose credit for Elfrid Payton being so bad? I don't know. That's a good question. I'd have to think about that, but it's a fair case, I think. I mean, certainly the Sixth Man of the last 2 weeks, Derek Rose is going to win that award. Bam Adebayo for third team All NBA. Center wise, like let's say you do like the center manipulation thing. Your candidates are basically Bam Adebayo. You've got Clint Capella, I guess. Wonder where Anthony Davis sort of fits on this. I mean, obviously he's down from the year he's had, but I mean, do you give Anthony Davis a nod in the same way you give LeBron a nod? Probably not. That's something to think about. Yeah, I don't know who. I mean, if it's not Bam, I'm not sure who else belongs. I guess the other question, I guess, is like, where do you put Zion deserve a mention over Butler or Paul George? And if you don't manipulate the forwards, do you put Zion on there? That's another one I think worth considering. I think he's had quite a crazy year. I guess it's Bam by default if you don't do that, though. I think his season's been a slightly overrated, but I don't really see any other candidate that you would put if you put both Jokic and Embiid on the first team. I'm not quite sure who else you would go with, if not that. Anyway, does anybody else want to make a case for anyone? Towns, yeah, I don't think Towns is a real candidate. For centers. I don't think Towns is a real candidate. Look, Clint Capella's had a really good year. Like, I think we may be getting a little ahead of ourselves with this whole NBA talk. You know, I think it's still like if you compare like Capella to Gobert in terms of the kind of center impact and the rolling impact that he may have. And like, if you're going to say that he has offensive value because of that, like, I just think it's so far below what Rudy provides for that team. Then you also consider that, you know, Clint is benefiting as much from Trae Young's passing and John Collins is rolling and all that. And Bogdan Bogdanovic, he's had a great season. I just don't think we need to stretch it to say that he belongs in the All NBA conversation. This is why I say just make it height dependent. That's where I'm going with this now. Height categories. Make it real simple. That's what I would say. Yeah, Jackson saying, I think Rudy's relationship as a lob threat is more mutually beneficial with ball handlers compared to Capella, who's more reliant. Yeah, absolutely. Plus, Gobert is a better screen setter. Plus, the relentlessness of Gobert's screen setting ability and the timing of his roles and the presence makes a big difference. So my point is that it's the same. It's just no comparison offensively and defensively. I think Gobert's better too. So, okay. I think that's pretty much it. Unless anyone wants to speak, I think we're going to wrap this thing up. Going once, going twice. Okay. This has been the Limited Upside NBA Award Advocacy Show. If you have anybody else that has not been mentioned, our friend on Twitter, what's his username? I shouldn't remember these things. Our friend Vitor TM Warning saying Raul Neto for Sixth Man of the Year. Raul Neto has had a terrific year. I am been amazingly surprised to watch it. So, yeah, let's give some Raul Neto some love. So that's that. But anyway, this has been the award advocacy show on the Limited Upside Live Chat. We'll be back next week where we are talking about the playing game. See you guys then.